Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Jennifer Goldsack, Interim Executive Director of the newly formed Digital Medicine Society, which seeks to put standards in place for the multiple stakeholders entering the growing world of digital medicine, 21st century technology-driven healthcare that will make it possible to develop digital medicine that's more precise and effective, more experimental, and more widely distributed. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea, improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Jennifer Goldsack here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Jennifer Goldsack, Interim Executive Director of the newly launched Digital Medicine Society, or DIME, the first professional organization for experts from all disciplines comprising the diverse field of digital medicine. She is VP of Digital Measurement at Monarch Biometrics. Prior to that, she spent several years at the Clinical Trials Transformation Initiative. A world-class rower, she competed in the 2008 Olympics. Ms. Goldsack earned her master's in chemistry from Oxford University, her master's of history and sociology of medicine from the University of Pennsylvania, and her MBA from George Washington University. Jennifer, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, and we've had many guests and had many conversations about digital medicine, and it really seems to infiltrate every aspect of healthcare. And I don't know if it's sort of tied back to the more than a decade ago, the launch of the iPhone, but we've seen a lot of things happen in this past decade that were exciting. And it's kind of surprising to see that a society hadn't yet been formed to help guide this evolving aspect of modern healthcare. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what's DIME's description of digital medicine, and why are you and your like-minded colleagues launching this venture? Tell us a little more about it.
Mm-hmm. So I think the description of digital medicine is a really good place to start, and it was very intentional. You hear a lot of terms being tossed around, digital health perhaps the most common. And when we describe digital medicine, I think the most helpful way to think about it is concentric circles. So broadly, digital health being this very wide sphere of digital tools that support health and wellness initiatives. Within that, we would define digital medicine specifically as one, those software-based tools designed to support the practice of medicine, whether that's diagnosis, whether that's treatment, whether it's monitoring, assessment, population health management. But critically important, and here I think is where the difference is between digital medicine and that broad definition of digital health, we are hoping to insist on digital medicine as being an evidence-based field. So specifically, those digital medicine tools are those software-based tools that support the practice of medicine very broadly, but are evidence-based. Worthwhile noting, I think, is within that definition, you would have digital therapeutics. So digital therapeutics would be a subset of digital medicine, but obviously those diagnostic, those measurement, those population health management tools would comprise the rest of the field. And then, Mark, you asked me also, I think, about sort of why the timing was right.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I talk with not just my colleagues within the leadership of DIME, but, you know, frankly, everyone who's been joining us as a member and many folks who have been affected by the field, what we see is huge promise, huge potential to improve health, healthcare, to reduce costs, to make it easier to access care. These are things that sort of as an industry we've been battling with for decades now with, you know, unfortunately, quite little success. We really see opportunity for these digital tools to actually make a difference, to actually affect some of these key criteria in healthcare. However, The reason I think the timing is right is the rate of innovation, the rate of growth of these digital medicine tools. On the one hand, it's proven the possibility, right? I think we've started to see evidence that, these tools can have an impact. But at the same time, it's been really difficult to keep pace with that evidence-based. You know, how can we make sure that the tools we're being asked to put our trust in are indeed trustworthy? And I think that's why this juncture is so important. And that's why, you know, the timing is right for a society like Dyme.
Well, Jennifer, as you've made clear already, digital medicine offers so much promise in terms of potentially eliminating barriers to care and increasing our scope and our capacity for biomedical research. But I want to talk about these big challenges that you've laid out. And I was kind of surprised at the lack of evidence being one of them. I thought we were further down the road with that. So we'd love for you to weigh in on that a little more. The second of three areas that you've identified as problematic doesn't surprise me at all, the fragmentation of data. And the third, isolated silos of progress, surprises me the least. I know you can't wave a wand and make all of these disappear as issues, but maybe share with us what you and your organization are planning to do about addressing these specific challenges so that you can make the progress that you think digital medicine has to offer us.
So let's start with evidence. You know, I think it's not up to a society to build the body of evidence for each of the individual digital medicine tools that we expect to see being rolled out and frankly that are currently being used. But I think one of the challenges is that these are brand new products being deployed in a very different way. So lack of evidence, I think, comes back to, and here's an example I always use. If you ask an engineer, and you ask a clinician, what does validation mean? They mean vastly different things. So how can you build towards a common body of evidence if actually the evidence being generated and that level of evidence, that framework of information that end users, whether that be a payer, a regulator, a prescribing clinician, or a patient, you know, how can we ask them to discern between different tools, know that they're safe, know that they're effective, if actually we're not starting from the same foundation? And similarly, I think that we have many brilliant engineers, technical experts entering a field that's highly regulated and that perhaps they haven't, you know, previously understood that there's a certain level of evidence that needs to be introduced. Similarly, on the clinical side, you know, really getting our clinical experts comfortable with the way that software is developed and validated, let's use that term again. So that's the piece that we're seeking to address on the evidence side of things. As I said, I don't think it's up to the society to be the decision maker on all of the different digital medicine products that are in place right now and coming down the pike, but certainly I take very seriously the responsibility of building a common framework for generating and evaluating that evidence. The second piece, as you mentioned, is fragmentation. And, you know, as I just mentioned, it's not just the fragmentation of data, it's these disciplines colliding. And how can we facilitate communication and education across and between those fragmented disciplines and experts? And the final piece that didn't surprise you at all, Margaret, was, you know, these sort of isolated silos of progress. And, you know, the reason I think that Dyme is so important is digital medicine is the most interdisciplinary field I can think of. And, you know, I've been thinking about this for a while now, and I don't think it's an overstatement. You know, we really need to have sort of white hat hackers at the table with payers and regulators. We need to have privacy and security experts talking with the product experts, with the clinicians, with the patients to see how the access and the functionality that they want jives with concerns about data security, data storage. How do we actually handle this? New data scientists at the table, you know, more data is not always better. Right. How can we thoughtfully think about what we collect and how it impacts? And so, you know, those isolated silos of progress, we help to be able to convene these experts and really share and advance a common understanding and a collaborative approach.
And Jennifer, you know, you have these building blocks that are in place for the work that you're doing. You know, it's sort of the base level is that we had the advent of really the scaling of electronic health records probably over the last 10 to 15 years as well. You've got patients across the country who are connecting themselves to wearables. Obviously, you have some large tech companies that are pushing wearables and people are engaged in them. And then you have this whole advent of a technological age of the 21st century. So tell us really where you are on your pathway of building this new society.
So it is an enormous task, Mark, but, you know, it's that throwaway phrase of, you know, how do you eat an elephant? And, you know, you take the first bite. And I think that's really important. We can't be paralyzed by the enormity of the task. And, you know, I think there was recent data that came out that said, you know, the digital medicine field will be valued at $250 billion by 2023 or something. And you think, well, gosh, we've got, you know, limited regulations and standards and evidence right now. How do we keep up? And, you know, starting, I think, is the most important. And I'm really proud of Dime in that respect and our leadership. We really only started talking about this in November, and we pushed incredibly hard and already have members worldwide, hundreds and hundreds. It's wonderful. There's a thriving community already. I think other critically important pieces will be, you know, doing this collaboratively. The army of one approach won't work, whether that's an individual organization or whether that's an individual group of stakeholders and experts. We need to do this collaboratively. And importantly, prioritizing. There are a lot of issues that need to be addressed. Which are the ones that currently are most pressing to ensure that these digital tools that we're placing our faith in are indeed safe and effective? Mm-hmm. And then the final piece that I think is really important, and Mark, you mentioned how wonderful our leadership is. We are incredibly fortunate with the strategic advisory and the scientific leadership boards we have as part of our governance structure at Dime. But, you know, I think what we would all agree is it's a new era, that it's this collision of these two different fields that think very differently. But at the same time, we don't have to completely tear up the playbook. There are scientific principles that should always prevail. Sure. And just because we may need to extrapolate them to a new world doesn't mean sure. we throw the baby out with the bathwater. So a lot of what we're doing is thinking critically about how can scientific and ethical standards that we've abided by and served as well for decades, how can they be extrapolated to this new era?
Well, obviously, enormous challenges. But when we think about the opportunities and the potential, it's pretty astonishing. And one of the areas that we're particularly interested in is research, really all kinds of research, but in particular clinical trials. You may know that our organization has been part of the All of Us initiative mm-hmm. since the beginning. So certainly thinking about how that works both for us locally as one organization, but also watching just the tremendous work being done at the national level on that project. And Mark, we had Apple's Jeff Williams with us a while ago talking about the Apple mm-hmm. Heart Study. You've done research on leveraging technology to improve mobile clinical mm-hmm. trials. How might clinical trials and research for the betterment of all be really transformed by digital interventions in the future?
It's a really good question. So, you know, talking at a really high level, there was actually a lovely piece that came out, I think, sometime last year by Eric Topol and Steve Steinhubel.
Right.
And their op-ed, I think, was something along the lines of digital medicine on its way to being just plain medicine. And
yep.
we don't say computers in business. They're just ubiquitous. They right. power everything right. we do across industry. And, you know, eventually I see that being the case in clinical trials. I'm really optimistic about how these digital technologies can affect clinical trials. And, you know, I see a number of different ways it will have impact. First, I think that these tools can power better quality, more patient-centric endpoints, specifically ones that will generate sort of better and more complete information about how potential new therapies work. I think that these tools could potentially support improved recruitment and retention, which we know are huge burdens in industry right now. They're driving up costs, they're slowing progress. We can do that by developing sort of endpoints that matter to patients, measuring them remotely with far reduced participation burden. I think another sort of way that these tools will impact clinical trials is almost an efficacy piece, right? If you can have a more sensitive measure, one that is, you know, sampling almost continuously, have a much greater data density, we have much more chance of making better decisions in early phase trials, better go, no-go decisions. We can fail faster and we can succeed much more cheaply and quickly, ultimately setting us up for sort of increased success for potentially successful treatments. And then the last thing that I think is important is, you know, this data density. really just driving the whole trial life cycle, really expediting the whole thing. And I think the best way to distill all this is to give an example. So I always think of Alzheimer's as being such a devastating condition. We know very well the heartbreaking and expensive late stage failures we've had with drug development in Alzheimer's. And it continues to amaze me that the gold standard endpoint in Alzheimer's, the UPDRS scale, was first introduced in 1987. It's a physician-administrated paper tool that's done once a visit. But yet this is an episodic condition. This is a condition where we see the symptoms playing out on an irregular basis. And we also know the burden to patients and caregivers of this disease. If we can stop putting the burden on patients to come into the clinic and only rely on snapshots of information to drive the trials, and instead, if we can put digital measurement tools out there in the field to power these studies, to get very good, high-quality, data-rich information very quickly about whether a new therapy might be successful, I think that could revolutionize the way that we think about clinical trials.
We're speaking today with Jennifer Goldsack, Interim Executive Director of the newly launched Digital Medicine Society, or DIME, the first professional organization for experts from all disciplines comprising the diverse fields of digital medicine. You know, Jennifer, one, I really like your North Star that this really needs to be an interdisciplinary collaboration.
Absolutely.
And that resonates in the era of team-based care where everybody's coming around the table. And there are a lot of folks that you've got engaged in this, ethicists, clinicians, researchers, white hat hackers. But I'm also wondering on the tech side, are you engaging people who are trying to advance the technology? I know there's a lot of conversations going on around 5G and other technologies that might be a force multiplier in the work that ultimately you're going to help provide some guide paths for. So multiple questions there, but just wondering, as you think about that collaborative nature, or are you pretty much letting the tech stuff happen and then observing it and also monitoring it and setting the standards for it?
The way we think about our leadership, the way we think about DIME membership, and the way, frankly, we think about the field and its success and advancing it for the betterment of sort of health and for patients, we really think about us sitting at the intersection of healthcare and technology. So for all the clinical experts we have, we also have that representation from the tech side. And you're exactly right. We are seeking input and expertise and collaborations all the way through all the way from those infrastructure experts that you mentioned can sort of power it with those broad brush strokes, all the way through to those really thoughtful, you know, software engineers and data scientists who are sort of crunching those algorithms to develop very specific measures. I think what's really important, and it's funny because I feel like sometimes clinical experts, you know, are worried about being squeezed out, and that's absolutely, you know, not the case. I don't think we can underestimate how important it is to remember that this is still healthcare. These are still healthcare tools. But at the same time, recognizing that the tools of this era, of this century, and of the future are digital ones, we need to promote that common understanding.
Well, Jennifer, I was struck a couple of minutes ago by your reference to that article where it was positing that we won't be saying digital medicine, it'll just be medicine, right? Mm-hmm. But one of the elements that maybe needs to get teased out a bit that I would really like for you to comment on is this: are there ethical considerations when we say digital medicine, at least today, when digital medicine is still kind of its own thing? Are there ethical considerations that are different from the other ethical considerations that we all know from, you know, starting first and foremost with do no harm? Maybe talk with us a little bit about that. And is that a subject of discussion in the society? Is there a group that's looking at whether there are specific ethical considerations to really be defined?
So I'll take that question in a few parts if I can, Margaret. So
sure.
First of all, I think that the ethical considerations are indeed very unique in this era of digital medicine. You know, when we are gathering data and information directly from patients when they go about their daily lives, you know, we are obviously understanding and documenting and recording information about them that we never have done in healthcare. oftentimes these different tools are, you know, you see things like the terms of use agreements, the privacy policies that you ask patients themselves to sort of review and agree to without that intermediary. That's extraordinary when you think about reducing costs, when you think about improving access, but there's absolutely ethical implications there. So that's sort of one piece of it. Yes, I think this is very unique. And the last piece of that too is, you know, the flow of the data. There are more people touch. I don't think people is the right way to think about it, but the data flow is different to how it existed previously in these static paper document forms where, you know, only the people with their hands on the physical data could access it. You know, now many, many people can access any given data point, and there are vulnerabilities at all sorts of different points in the chain that we need to be aware of. And again, there's a trade-off between the sort of access and privacy. And I think that trade-off is really important. You mentioned the, you know, to do no harm, and that always has connotations with the Hippocratic Oath that clinicians and physicians specifically, swear to when they launch their career. There's a fantastic organization, I Am the Cavalry, who have come up with a security-focused Hippocratic Oath for connected devices. And I recommend if anyone listening hasn't read that yet, take a look at that and consider it. And then the last piece to answer your question, Margaret, I think, we take the need for a very, very focused ethical framework that really is sort of patient-centric. I talked before about sort of prioritizing those areas where work is required. That's absolutely top of our list. We're actually currently building a working group to advance work on ethics in digital medicine right now. And, you know, the approach that we'll take will not surprise you based on the conversation to date. You know, it really needs to be collaborative. It's interesting. I have seen some quite high-profile sort of documents and 10 principles spin out. And then you look at who was in the room and there wasn't a patient in sight. Mm-hmm. And you just think, Well, you know, my personal opinion is that that's a mistake.
Yep.
And I also think that, you know, that collaborative approach is because there are new problems to solve for. Some of the data access, the sheer volume of data and information we have on any individual and how that allows us to connect dots that we never have been able to before. These are new challenges. And, that's why we're excited to tackle this and think we're well placed to do so.
We've been speaking today with Jennifer Goldsack, Interim Executive Director of the newly launched Digital Medicine Society, or DIME, the first professional organization for experts from all disciplines comprising the diverse field of digital medicine. You can learn more about their work and add your own voice to the conversation by going to dimesociety.org, or you can follow them on Twitter at @_DIMESociety. Jennifer, this is really important work. It's timely, and we appreciate your forward thinking and vision, and thank you for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Margaret, thanks for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Recently, two Democrats, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and former President Barack Obama, distorted the facts on the public health issue of guns. Gillibrand, a Democratic presidential candidate, claimed President Donald Trump failed to keep his promise after a mass shooting in Las Vegas in 2017 to ban bump stocks. Trump may not have moved as quickly as Gillibrand would have liked, but Trump did enact a bump stock ban, which went into effect in March. At a town hall event hosted by Fox News in June, Gillibrand said Trump was, quote, beholden to the NRA, claiming he said he was going to ban bump stocks but didn't because of the NRA. Shortly after the Las Vegas shooting, the NRA said it didn't support a total ban on bump stocks or legislative action. It preferred revised regulations from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. A bump stock is a plastic or metal device that can be attached to the rear of a semi-automatic rifle to make it shoot almost as fast as a fully automatic weapon. It did take some time, but ultimately on December 18, 2018, the Department of Justice and ATF issued a new federal regulation officially banning bump stocks. The rule required the owners of any bump stocks to destroy the device or turn them in at an ATF office prior to March 26, when the rule went into effect. An NRA spokeswoman said the organization was disappointed with the rule because it didn't provide a grandfather clause for those who already had the devices. Gillibrand's campaign told us she was referring to the time right after the Las Vegas shooting when Trump initially supported a bump stock ban and then faced NRA criticism. But the Trump administration did move through the bureaucratic channels and ultimately enacted a regulation to ban bump stocks. At a technology conference in Brazil, former President Obama misrepresented U.S. gun laws, claiming that, quote, anybody can buy any weapon without much, if any, regulation, including, he said, machine guns. Machine guns have been tightly regulated since 1934 and banned since 1986, except for the sale or transfer of such a weapon that was lawfully owned and registered before May 1986. Even then, such a machine gun can only be transferred from one registered owner to another registered owner. A machine gun is defined by law as a fully automatic weapon, one that can shoot automatically more than one shot with a single trigger function without manual reloading. A spokesman for Obama said the former president used the term machine gun when he meant semi-automatic weapons that are currently legal to purchase in the U.S., such as AR-15 rifles. Obama may not draw a distinction between a semi-automatic and a fully automatic weapon, but the law does. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
One in five Americans will suffer a diagnosable mental health condition in a given year, and most often don't seek treatment. For those with serious mental health conditions, the consequences can be devastating. Hospitalizations, loss of job or home, or even early death. Seeing a rise in mobile apps aimed at behavioral health entering the marketplace, University of Washington researcher Dror Ben Zev thought a comparative effective analysis study would be a good idea.
My team and I conducted a 3-year comparative effectiveness trial with the objective of having a head-to-head comparison between a mobile health intervention for people with serious mental illness called FOCUS and a more traditional clinic-based group intervention. So it's conducted at a clinic setting, people with similar diagnoses. So the study really gets at some of the core differences between mobile health and clinic-based care. Is there something about the mobile health approach that would make it more accessible or less accessible?
More than 90% of the mobile app group engaged in the online program, which was a series of text messages offering coping strategies and self-monitoring of symptoms, along with weekly call-ins with a behavioral health clinician.
So we measure to see whether involvement in both interventions for a 12-week period, would that create some sort of difference in psychiatric symptom severity and quality of life. And 90% of the individuals who were randomized into the mobile health arm actually went on to meet a mobile health specialist who described the app to them and trained them how to use it and used the intervention app that's assigned to them at least once. Whereas in the clinic-based arm, we saw that only 58% of the participants assigned to that clinic-based intervention ever made it in for a single session.
Ben Zev says this suggests that mobile therapies may provide a useful tool for clinicians having trouble getting those with serious mental health issues to engage with the clinical interventions.
The group dynamics, that on its own is quite potent for people. But for others, the interaction is anxiety provoking. Just making it to the clinic to engage in that interaction is logistically complex. When it comes to the clinical outcomes, In both intervention arms, people improved both in terms of reduction in their symptoms and the distress associated with symptoms and improvements in their recovery.
A targeted mobile app aimed at facilitating access to clinical care for those experiencing serious mental illness symptoms, proving equally effective in managing the condition, improving access to intervention for behavioral health needs. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.